You're listening to the Scottish Football Forums podcast, the home of Scottish football banter.
Morning, welcome to the Scottish Football Forums podcast with myself, Dave. I'm joined this morning by Fiona Skillen. Fiona, just for our viewers out there, is doing a couple of women's football shows coming up. Fiona, I'd like you to introduce yourself. What is it you're planning to do? They're both in Edinburgh, am I correct in saying that?
They are. So, hi everyone. I'm Professor Fiona Skillen and I work at Glasgow Caledonian University. And I've just finished a project for FIFA, which was looking at the history of women's football in Scotland. And I'm going to be doing two public talks on those findings about women's football in Edinburgh in the next month. So the first one is on the 7th of March. And that is part of the Society of Antiquaries. So if you Google that or you go on Eventbrite and you put in Fiona Skillen and football, you will come up with the booking form there. It's free to come along. It's March the 7th, 6 p.m. till 7 p.m. And the second event I'm doing is with the National Library of Scotland. And that is on the 21st of March. And that's 5:30 till 6:30. And those are free events, but you do need to book a ticket. And one of them is online. I think the first one on the 7th is online as well. So if you can't make it along to Edinburgh in person, you can sign up and watch online.
Absolutely. With these events, Fiona, it's about looking at women's football in the past. Without divulging too much information, what is expected from both of these evenings?
So the first talk on the 7th is going to be looking at a very broad history of women's football. So we often think of women's football as being quite a modern thing, that women really didn't start playing until maybe the 1960s or 70s in Scotland. But in actual fact, women have been playing since the 1560s in Scotland. And so on that night, I'm going to be talking a little bit about the types of places, the types of women, the types of games that they've played over the last few hundred years. And on the 21st, I'm going to be focusing primarily on the First World War and women's football. It was a huge growth period for women's football during the First World War. So I'm going to be looking a little bit at that and how that sort of developed in Scotland specifically. So the different factories and things that women were working in and how they developed football from those factories.
Who was successful at that time? Who was like winning trophies? Who was top of the ladder at that point?
Well, so the biggest team probably, and the one that no one really talks about, and they should, I think, be shouting from the rooftops, is Rutherglen Ladies. So Rutherglen Ladies were formed in 1921. So they were formed just after the end of the First World War, and they kind of came out of a lot of these factory teams. There was a great guy called Mr. James Kelly, who was a kind of entrepreneur, and he saw there was a gap and that this was an opportunity to set up this fantastic team. And what he did was he sort of headhunted women from lots of different factory teams and brought them together to form Rutherglen Ladies, and they were phenomenal. They played all over Scotland. They played against other women's teams. They played against men's teams. They played against men's teams in fancy dress. They travelled to Ireland and they did two tours of Ireland, which when you think of the logistics of the time period we're talking about, that's a really difficult thing for these women to do. They went to England and really they were the equivalent of the Dick Kerr's Ladies. So we've heard about the Dick Kerr's Ladies from that period as being the kind of big team. And they were kind of the Scottish equivalent. They weren't as global or as successful as Dick Kerr's, but they're basically our equivalent and a story that everyone should know, I think.
Absolutely. With regards to the Rutherglen Ladies, obviously they were very, very good at the time. And that was before the World War obviously kicked off. So regarding Rutherglen, they obviously set that precedent for what was to come moving forward.
Absolutely. So I think what's really interesting is that Rutherglen emerged in 1921 just as the FA are bringing in a ban in England. So the FA brought in a ban in England to stop women playing football on any of their association grounds and using any of their qualified referees. And there are lots of different explanations for why that happened. In Scotland, we didn't have a ban in 1921. We brought in a ban in the 1940s. However, attitudes towards women playing football became very hostile in the 1920s, and that kind of continued. And so what's really interesting is with the Rutherglen Ladies, they're playing just at a time when we would expect these teams to be closing down, they're actually forming and they're getting a lot of publicity and people are writing about them and thousands of people are coming to watch them. So they're real pioneers. They're pushing back at a time when people were very hostile to women's football. So it's really interesting because of the time period. It's really interesting because of the attitudes. And obviously, as I touched on there, we had a ban brought in the 1940s and we were the last country to lift our ban in Europe.
You touched upon the crowds there, Fiona. In the men's game, you see some of the cup finals, you see some of the, even the junior cup finals in Scotland around about that time. What crowds were the women's game getting at the time?
So we're probably talking a couple of thousand. We know that there are examples where up to sort of 10,000 people were coming to watch these games. And I think it probably is because they're unusual. One of the arguments about the ban being brought in England is that the women's games were attracting large crowds, and so there was a fear that maybe they were going to, you know, take away fans from the men's game. But in actual fact, when you look at the numbers, they're really not as significant as those that are coming along to the men's game in this period. But nonetheless, they're much, much larger than the crowds that we currently see, even though it's the fastest growing game in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny as well, Fiona, because see, when you listen to interviews with players, like maybe played the 1980s, 1990s, and they've all went and says, like, I tried to play with the boys' team, but I couldn't play with the boys' team because the teacher didn't allow me. Yeah. It's funny how in the 1920s there was that barrier, and there was still that barrier even maybe in the 1990s.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think sometimes, you know, people can be very disparaging of women's football and dismissive and say it's not as good as the men's game, which I think there are lots of ways to knock that into touch. I think the fact that they had this ban for so many years has really held back the development of the women's game. It certainly held back investment in the women's game, respect for the women's game and professionalisation of the women's game, which we're now seeing is happening at a great rate of knots, which is fantastic. But I think that ban really had this huge impact, this huge legacy. And I think also the kind of attitudes towards women's sport. I mean, men and women do play football differently. Stylistically, they are very different, so it's hard to compare them. But also, I think it's unfair to compare them because the men's game has had so long to evolve and so much investment, so much support around it, that it isn't a fair comparison.
I mean, it's been well documented, Fiona. We only need to go back to Ibrox last week and we don't need to divulge too much information to that. But
yeah,
what happened with that was quite simply a sign of where the women's game is at. But also, that's just a sign of what we've had in the women's game for generations, at least three times over.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think the incidents, you know, around last week's match are perhaps peculiar to the Old Firm. You know, I would suggest that the sort of the rivalry there perhaps brings a different dynamic. In my experience, going to women's matches, the atmosphere is very different to going to men's matches. It's very much a family atmosphere, which I think is great. And it's a very different attitude. You know, people clap when, you know, even if somebody sort of misses the ball or whatever, there's a very different attitude. There's less aggression. There's less violent language and so forth. It's very, very different. And I think maybe what we saw last week is a sort of shift, where because we're seeing this professionalisation of the game, because we're seeing increasing investment in the game, it is becoming more popular, and maybe we will see more of a shift towards the kind of fan culture that we see around the men's game, which I don't necessarily think is a good thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. When you look at, obviously, back then, what was superior about women's football at the time that obviously catched your imagination personally?
I think what captured my imagination was just the spirit that these women had to kind of push back at a time where it was incredibly negative towards women taking up this sport and having the guts to go out there and play in front of large crowds and sometimes to play and have abuse hurled at them. We know the women that were playing in the Victorian era, for example, there's numerous examples of them having to be sort of chaperoned off the pitch because people are throwing things at them. They're attacking their cart that's kind of taking them away from the game. So there was physical and there was mental abuse being hurled at these players. And I think across the generations, we can see that women have had to overcome a lot of obstacles that society have thrown in their way in order to play a game that they're really passionate about. And I think I find that really inspiring.
You've done a lot for the women's game, Fiona. Maybe just give an insight into yourself and what you've done, because you've done some stuff for the BBC, haven't you?
Yeah, so, I mean, I very much see my role. I'm a historian. I research women's sport. And what drives me is uncovering stories that people don't know about or should know about, or perhaps are only known by a few people. And I'm really passionate about sharing those stories. So, you know, as you touched on there, I've done a lot of work with the media. So I've done quite a few television programmes. I made a documentary with myself and a guy called Steve Bolton, who's also a great football historian, made a documentary about Eddie Reader and her granny, who was a player for Rutherglen Ladies, and that story. So that was with the BBC. I've recently contributed to a documentary about the development of football in Scotland and the kind of origins of football, the story there. And I filmed that with Dougray Scott and Rose Riley, which was a wonderful experience. So any opportunity that comes my way, if people ask me to talk about football or indeed any kind of women's sport that I've done research in, I'm very happy to do that, because I think these women are pioneers and their stories should be shared because they're inspirational. I think they're really, for young girls who are playing and coming through the system, and women coming through the system as well, I think perhaps there's some comfort in knowing other people have gone before them and faced similar struggles.
Did I see you did some stuff with the Western Scotland Cricket Club recently?
Yeah, I did. So that's part of a sort of bigger project called the Hamdeners, which is a collection of historians who are excited and spreading the word about the origins of football in Scotland. So what we're trying to demonstrate is that there's this really rich and often overlooked history around football and its origins, of the particularly of the passing game. There's evidence to suggest that that came from Scotland, and that there's lots of other elements of the modern game that we can see coming out of Scotland that we've kind of forgotten, because the overall message is often, you know, football's coming home and it's coming to England, but actually there are elements of the game that are Scottish. And so that's what that group is trying to do, and as part of that I'm trying to publicise the women's stories.
I'll tell you why I bring the West Scotland Cricket Club up, Fiona, because last year on the Scottish Football Forums podcast team, we all went to the West Scotland Cricket Club, went and watched a cricket game, but we were told about everything about all the football games that have been happening, both the men's and the women's game.
Absolutely, yeah. So the West of Scotland Cricket Round is really interesting because it was the site of some of the very early games of football, and a lot of people don't realise that. And also that a lot of the Scotch professors, so these are the people who helped develop the game and then set down the rules and then take those rules and ideas out into the wider world, actually, you know, were involved in cricket as well. And again, this is a very kind of overlooked story, the kind of interconnectedness between different sports and football. And that's part of what the Hamdeners are doing, is kind of trying to tease apart some of those elements of the story and celebrate them.
Yeah, absolutely. So what happened after the Rutherglen Ladies? How did women's football evolve after that? What was life like after World War?
So we know that some women did continue to play. And in fact, we know right the way through until the 70s, women were playing in small numbers, often in kind of regional areas. So maybe one or two teams at sort of regional places, but not generally playing against one another across Scotland. It's not until the late 60s, early 70s that we really start to see that happening with any kind of sort of organisation and frequency. And we see the establishment of the Scottish Women's Football, or the precursor to the Scottish Women's Football Association, happening in the early 70s, while the ban is still in place. So we have this really odd situation where in 1971, UEFA write to all of their members and they ask them, is women's football growing in your area? And if you have a ban or some sort of restrictions in place, would you be willing to lift them? And all of the members, so I think there was 31 members, all of them wrote back and said, absolutely, there's interest, it's growing, and we're going to lift our ban. And the only country that didn't was Scotland. So we have this really odd situation where in England, they lift the ban, they set up the Women's Football Association, and it gets a little bit of funding from the Sports Council. But in Scotland, although we have a Scottish Women's Football Association, it's not recognised by the SFA, it's given no support, And we have our very first international match between England and Scotland happening in 1972. And that happens down at Ravenscraig in Greenock. And it's a phenomenal match, and it's quite kind of, you know, sensationalised in the press. But these women are not recognised for playing in that match until very recently, because the ban was in place. So the ban stays in place until 1974, which is really quite late if you think about it, you know, for that ban to be lifted. But all the women who played for Scotland between that match in 72 and I think it's 1995, none of them had caps for representing Scotland. And that's something that I've been working with the SFA along with on a project led by Dr. Karen Grunwell at Stirling University. We've been working together to help trace some of those women, to verify who was actually, you know, playing for Scotland, and get them caps, get in contact with them, and then get them caps. And I should mention also Andy Mitchell, another phenomenal football historian, who's been helping greatly in that process as well, because it's really tricky, as you can imagine, because there's so few archives for us to actually kind of explore. It's very tricky to work out, you know, who actually played, who got on the pitch, who was on the sidelines, which matches count, because there's lots of variation about, you know, where they're played, how they're played, and so forth. So which matches should be recognised, and then actually physically finding these women who are scattered all over the world to make contact with them, or their families if they're no longer with us, in order to invite them back to Hampden to get awarded their cap. So it's been a really complex process.
I remember that 1972 match. I watched a documentary on it recently.
Yeah.
And I remember being a bit flabbergasted about the whole thing.
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's quite, when I found out, I was quite shocked that these women who had represented their country hadn't had caps. I was sort of outraged, if I'm honest. So I think it's great that the SFA have recognised that and are now putting that right. It's a gradual process because it takes time in order to do all these checks and so forth and to make contact with everyone. So we're kind of doing them in batches, which is great. It's sometimes hard to persuade the women to come back because obviously they feel, well, I didn't get it at the time, why should I bother now? And we, you know, we're trying to say, well, this is what you should have had, and this is right that you're getting this now. And when they do come, I've been to two out of the three sessions now where we've given caps. Usually they happen when we have a big national international match, yeah, at Hampden. It's been amazing seeing the women all coming together, and we try to do them around, you know, kind of blocks of matches, so that it's people who might have played together. And so often they've not seen each other for 20, 30, sometimes longer years. So it's really quite moving seeing them all coming together and seeing each other for the first time, and the excitement of it all as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned Rose Riley there. Now, Rose Riley is a podcast within itself. That's well beyond our time. But in terms of Rose Riley, I mean, she was really the pinnacle of Scottish football. She was really the individual, really catapulted, pardon me, Scottish women's football.
Absolutely. Rose is a living legend. You know, I think we can't take away from, you know, her achievements in any way, both at home and abroad. You know, Rose played in Scotland in the 70s and then went over to first to France and then to Italy and made a career over there when there was absolutely no chance of making a professional career here playing football. And she was a phenomenal talent. And because she went to play abroad, she was banned from playing for Scotland. So it was a huge loss to Scottish women's football that she went abroad. But luckily for us, she came back near, you know, just after she'd retired, she came back to live in Scotland, and since then she's been a fantastic ambassador for the women's game, really doing a lot of media work, going along to work with young girls that are coming through the system, to promote the women's game and give voice to the women's game, which is great. And I mean, there are other women as well that, you know, I'm thinking of people like Sheila Begbie, Elsie Cook, Shelley Kerr, who have also done huge things for the women's game and continue to bang that drum and give profile to the women's game as well. So I think we're really lucky we have these really strong women who have very strong voices continuing to advocate for the women's game even after their playing careers or administrative careers have ended.
It would be remiss of me not to ask about the start of women's football. Where did it all begin? What was the process like prior to even the World War, even prior to Ronald Reagan Ladies? How did it all start?
Sure. So, as I said right at the start, we have some evidence of women playing football back in the 1560s. And that's a minister who is writing to say that that women are playing football and men are playing football and they're not coming to church. So they're doing lots of other fun things, but they're not coming to church, and he's very annoyed about this. But luckily for us, because he was so annoyed, he wrote it down. So we have a record showing that men and women were playing football in that period. But really, formalised football doesn't start until the Victorian era. And that formalised football is... Yeah. Played more along a kind of similar association lines that we would understand now, sort of similar rules and regulations. And we see women starting to play, and really there's kind of one big team at that time, the British Ladies Football Club. And they play all over Britain, and they play local teams sometimes who have been kind of cobbled together for matches, or sometimes they take like a B-side with them so that they've always got somebody kind of decent to play against. And the reception that they get is very varied. So they get huge numbers of people coming to watch them, but often they're coming to kind of laugh at them and to jeer at them and shout things at them. And sometimes it becomes violent and things are thrown at them and they're attacked. And it kind of comes to a sticky end when they are basically they're bankrupted because the kind of, I guess, the novelty has worn off and not as many people come to the games. Yeah. And so they end up losing money on the games, and it all kind of falls apart in the kind of mid-1890s. And then there's a huge sort of gap where we know women are, you know, maybe playing kickabouts, you know, like on Sunday school trips and those sorts of things. We've got the odd reference, but we have no evidence of actual teams playing in that period until the First World War breaks out. And then suddenly, like mushrooms, they're all springing up all over the place, these teams in factories where women are playing.
Yeah, absolutely. Because if you look at that, that's basically just catapulted the women's game. It basically started with something based on people going to church, and it's allowed us to grow into the professional, evolutionised the women's game that we know for today. But as you alluded to earlier on, we're maybe 10, 20 years ahead, behind our own target because of our inability to really understand what it was like in the 1970s.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think we can underestimate the impact that, you know, the ban and all the stuff that goes with that, the kind of misogyny and discrimination that went with that, in terms of undermining the growth of the women's game. And I think it's had far-reaching effects. And I think, you know, we're still seeing that now. You know, there's still lots of examples of young girls going to training, and they train after the boys, so their training maybe doesn't start till like 8 o'clock at night. So, you know, they're not getting a fair kick of the ball. They're being treated like second class citizens in many respects. So we still see those issues, and I think part of that is justified. You know, people try to justify it by saying, oh, the women's game isn't economically as important as the men's game, and that's true. But the women's game is the fastest growing sport globally at the moment, and so its time is coming. And I would love to think that Scotland could be part of that and be ahead of the curve and make lots of changes so that we are at the forefront of women's football.
I mean, Rachel Corsi, I was listening to a podcast when she was at Aberdeen, and she was saying about how she had to train at Pitotti's car park, and that was 20 years ago. Now she's training at Villa, Aston Villa, where she'll have state-of-the-art training facilities.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And I think we made such strides, you know, after we had the Olympics and the World Cup and so forth, women's football was making huge, huge strides. And then we had COVID and we had lockdown, and the women's game was one of the first to be shut down. So it's kind of, you know, on the one hand, we're making huge progress, but we need to consolidate that progress. And I think we kind of got knocked back a bit by COVID. So hopefully things are on a positive turn now.
Okay. Is there anything we can reflect on moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think celebrating this long history is important. I think showing that we have this long history and being proud of that history and how far we've come despite the obstacles that have been flung in our way by various organisations and individuals is really important. And I think we can learn from that, that having stamina, having perseverance, you can play and be successful at the game you want to play if you're passionate about it.
Are you disappointed there's not been enough coverage on this front?
Yeah, I would love to have more coverage, and I'm working very hard on that. I've got 3 books coming out in the next year or so. One is a monograph, so one is a book about the history of women's football in Scotland that I'm writing with Karen Grunwell at Stirling. So that'll be a really detailed history of women's football. Another one is a celebration of women's football in Scotland, and that's going to be poetry and short essays and, you know, fun interviews, and it's really accessible. And then the third one is an academic book, which is looking at the history of women's football across Britain and Ireland, and lots of different academics have contributed to that collection. So I'm hoping by doing all of these books, by doing interviews like this and being invited onto great podcasts like this, public talks like the ones I'm doing in Edinburgh, that more and more people will hear these stories and will be interested and will go away and find out more.
Well, we know you're a broadcaster, Fiona, but we didn't know you were an author. So that's great to say, because there's plenty of people on our podcast who are authors.
Fantastic. That's great.
So when are these books expected to be published?
So we're hoping to have most of them by the end of the year, because there's a big anniversary coming up. It's the 50th anniversary of the lifting of the ban in Scotland. And so I would love to do lots more media work around that and celebrating that ban. And so I'm hoping to have at least one, if not 2 or 3 of the books out by then to celebrate that.
Yeah, that would basically just take a huge weight off your shoulders, because you've been, I bet, scratching your head going, we need to celebrate women's football, we need to get more out there for the women's game.
Absolutely. And so I'm having lots of conversations with people now who are involved in the women's game to kind of say, what can we do to mark this important event? What can we do to celebrate it? And so hopefully something, we'll be doing something, if not a series of events, kind of round about end of August, beginning of September, hopefully, because the ban was, I think it was the 24th of August that it was lifted.
Have you had any conversations with Fiona McIntyre or that?
Yes, so we're talking to all the football organisations, so Fiona McIntyre, Vivian McLaren, some of the teams as well. So we've talked to various different teams and organisations, so there does seem to be an appetite to do something, but what that will be, we're not quite sure. But I'll let you know. When I know, I'll let you know, so the listeners can sign up for it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, myself and Mr. John Blaisdell come, because we're the main women's football extraordinaires. So all the rest of them are men's. We actually have quite a good variety. Some like women's football, some like men's football. But that obviously comes within itself. Obviously, people have had this perception for a long time now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're right. A lot of people were either men's supporters or women's supporters, and now we're starting to see a bit more of a crossover, which is quite exciting. You know, and again, things like we're starting to see the kind of really hardcore fans for the men's game starting to come along to the women's game, which is great. And also women's matches starting to happen in the kind of main stadium. So, you know, you mentioned Ibrox there earlier on, but also, you know, we've seen it happen at Tynecastle and Easter Road as well. And okay, it's not every match, but I think just having some
Hampden
matches
well.
And Hampden as well and Celtic Park, I think having some matches at these big stadiums just acknowledges that growth and that willingness of these clubs to be supporting the women's game and growing the women's game.
Finally, Fiona, before we finish, anything to round off or anything you'd like to add?
No, just thank you for having me. It's been great talking about this history. As you can tell, I'm really passionate about it. So I love having an opportunity to talk about it. And hopefully some of your listeners might come along to these talks on the 7th and 21st of March. And I will let you know when their publications come out. And hopefully some of them will be interested in that as well.